Hello, and welcome to the 1840 Podcast, where each month we explore different topics, balancing modern sensibilities with traditional sensitivities, to give you new approaches to timeless Jewish ideas. I'm your host, David Beshefkin, and this month we are talking about the topic of agunos, women in chained marriages. It could also be men, as we will discuss and talk about. This podcast is part of a larger exploration of those big, juicy Jewish ideas. So be sure to check out 1840.org, that's 1840.org, where you can find videos, articles, and recommended readings. One more super fun thing that I just want to mention off of the top is that our anniversary, our one-year anniversary is coming up soon, and we are asking our listeners, our guests, people within our orbit, to maybe have a little fun and call in with a voice note, voicemail, where your voice, you don't have to say who you are. Jews hate saying who their name is. You could just, you don't have to say your first name, your last name, but you can call in, give us feedback, ask us questions, and hopefully we'll have some of our listeners featured on a special episode. You can leave a voicemail at this number, 917-720-5629. Again, that's 917-720-5629. Write down that number and give us a call. Give us some of your feedback. What did you hate? What did you love? What are some residual questions you have? And we've actually been getting quite a bit of feedback on this very topic, the topic of agunos. And that's absolutely no surprise, as we spoke about in our introduction. This is a fraught topic. I know this because not only do I know people who have been stranded in these situations, but I know it's harder to talk about because, A, so much of the attention is happening right now. There's no distance, so to speak, and there's a lot of attention on this. And I always have the concern that I'm going to say something wrong, and I likely already have in these 3 minutes that I've been talking about. We got another one of those emails, by the way, that my introductions are too long. But I also can say we want longer introductions, and I don't know how to make it perfect. But we, as we always do, we'll keep on trying. I am so excited about today's guest, and I picked the guest very carefully and very deliberately. Because when the attention to this issue came out, I know there are people who bristle at the notion of even talking about this because in their minds, there is this sense of trying to resolve or bring any change to the world of agunos necessarily means the abrogation, the change, the deterioration of our halachic norms and systems. And that was not really something that I wanted to be party to. I think what we try to do on this podcast is figure out how within that normative world of commitment to halacha, that normative Jewish world, how can we still find that creativity, that excitement, that joyfulness, that satisfaction that we all seek, even through points of dissonance. And there's no question that this topic is one big point of dissonance. I was thinking before I introduce our guest of kind of like some of the pushback of why this topic is fraught for many people. So I actually have a little bit of a personal story with this. A lot of the pushback has to do with earlier changes that people made or suggestions to the institution of marriage within the Jewish community and how they were summarily, rightfully rejected. One of the most notable rabbis to do that was Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who my life has kind of crossed paths. I didn't know him personally. He died when I was in yeshiva. I was actually at his funeral, which I have a story about. But Rabbi Rachman did make fairly radical suggestions about how we should address the issue of agunot. And it was pushed back quite forcefully, quite emphatically by Rabbi Soloveitchik. I believe in an address to the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, he said, while even knowing all of the empathy and sensitivity needed, we can't just willy-nilly. It's a word that Rabbi Soloveitchik liked to use a great deal if you're familiar with his writing. I have no idea why, but I also have fallen in love with the word willy-nilly from the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. It doesn't get enough attention. When you think Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings, you usually think of the words like ontological, epistemological. He liked those fancy words. The term that doesn't get enough attention, without a doubt, is the term willy-nilly. And we can't be willy-nilly with our halachic institutions. There's no question about that. And he pushed back quite hard on Rabbi Rachman. Now, it happens to be Rabbi Rachman was I believe the founding rabbi of my childhood shul, which has over the years gone quite a bit far from the personality of Rabbi Rachman and some of the controversies that were associated with him later on in life. And not only that, but I went to yeshiva with Rabbi Rachman's grandson. And after Rabbi Rachman died, he left an incredible, incredible library. And I remember his grandson, after the family all took what they wanted, invited me and one of my dear friends, his name is Aryeh, and we drove out. We got into a car accident on the way. A little bit of a fender bender, but it took me about 3 months to resolve, to Rabbi Rachman's garage, where we got to his son's garage, where we got to kind of take the svarim that we were interested in because the family had already taken. And I remember being struck by how many copies of this book, this soft cover, almost like a big, large pamphlet called Tears of the Oppressed, which was a book I believe that Rabbi Rachman commissioned to talk about Agunot, even though his suggestions were very much rejected by most leaders and halachic thinkers in the Orthodox community. Interestingly enough, I did go to Rabbi Rachman's funeral. And I remember at his funeral, I saw my childhood Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the elementary school that I went to. I went to Yeshivas Toras Chaim of South Shore. And at the funeral, it was an incredible funeral. It was really being a part of Jewish history. He was over 100, I believe, when he died. And I remember Deborah Lipstadt spoke at his funeral. And I remember looking down and seeing somebody with a long a frock and an up hat, not somebody who I would have thought who would have kind of showed up to Rabbi Rachman's funeral. It came from a storied rabbinic family. His father has a collection of correspondence with so many leading Jewish thinkers called Kiryas Chana David, I believe, a fabulous collection of Rabbi Rachman's father's correspondence with people like Rav Kook and so many other Jewish leaders at the time. But at Rabbi Rachman's funeral, I looked down, I was sitting on the balcony, and I saw somebody wearing a frock and up hat, and I noticed this is the Rosh Yeshiva from my elementary school, Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky, who also has since passed away. He was the son of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, a famous Torah leader in Canada and America, who originally studied in Slabodka. You can learn more about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky on our dear friend's podcast, Yehuda Geber's Jewish History Podcast. I think he just spoke about Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. And we saw his son, Rav Binyamin, there. And I remember a few weeks later, Binyamin was fairly sick at the time. And a few weeks or months later, maybe even after he passed, I have to remember, I went to South Shore and I asked him, I said, it was so interesting, what was Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky doing there? He was kind of aligned with a little bit more of a right-wing Orthodox community. I wouldn't have expected to see him at Rabbi Rachman's funeral. And he told me something really remarkable. He said that when they were first starting the Five Towns, when they were first building the community of the Five Towns, and a little trivia of which are the Five Towns, you could ask yourself, you could name all five. He was starting South Shore and the girls' school, and they had difficulty fundraising. And Rabbi Rachman at the time was far more famous, far more established, and he sent donors to help Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky establish what is now the Woodmere community and the schools and the girls' school that he helped set up, which I believe was TAG. I think all of this, I may be getting a lot of facts wrong here, but he definitely sent donors to Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky to help this fledgling person rise up and establish himself, which has now, you know, transformed the entire Woodmere community. So after seeing Rav Binyamin Kamenetsky there, even though there are those who have very serious objections to Rabbi Rachman and his suggestions, particularly on the topic of Agunot, as Rabbi Soloveitchik Soloveitchik Express, and we could have links about some of those debates on our website. But I think there is a measure of respect and appreciation that we should still have for his contribution of how he built Torah in America. We have a hard time imagining what that world was like in the 50s, 60s, when he was the rabbi of Shaarei Tefillah, where I grew up, and really helping rabbis, regardless of their specific affiliation, build communities, which is really something remarkable. And it is nice that in my library now, I still have books from Rabbi Rachman's library. I think my most prized possession is the work called Meshev Milchama, which is about the laws related to the army, written by the chief rabbi, Rev Gorin, who is the chief rabbi of Israel. I believe the third or fourth chief rabbi of Israel. And Rev Gorin inscribed it to Rabbi Rachman. Rev Gorin had his own controversies in his own right, but it was really nice to see them, so to speak, corresponding with one another. Our guest today is Keshet Star, and Keshet Star is the chief executive officer of an organization called ORA, which is the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. I did not know much about ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. I kind of always looked at it really for personality reasons with a degree of, I don't know, suspicion. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'm always getting nervous. I'm not the rally type. Even when I believe in the cause, I'm just not the type to sit outside of the house and scream into a megaphone. It's just not my personality. It's not my style. I don't know that I would be able to do that, not because I don't take this issue seriously, but I genuinely have a hard time doing that. And when I first, it's actually interesting, when ORA first started, it was run by somebody named Jeremy Stern. He was before Keshet Star. And there was a fellowship in YU for rabbinical students that I applied for, and I lost out to Jeremy Stern until he announced that he planned on making Aliyah, and then I actually got a spot in the fellowship. I believe you could still look it up. If you Google my name in rabbinical fellowship, you could still find out there's a whole story about that fellowship, but Jeremy Stern almost got my spot in that fellowship, and since moving on, he works for a different organization now. Keshet Star, who is a lawyer who works and is the chief executive officer for the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot, really helped me understand what on earth do they do. It's a lot more than just protesting outside of homes, which was kind of that my visceral reaction, like, ah, it's just not my style. I don't know that I could do that. And there's so much more that they do behind the scenes that's actually quite more impactful. And she has a really fascinating perspective on what role that imagery and the protests, all of that has in the larger process of Agunot. It's really the method of absolute last resort. And I think the work that she's doing is absolutely crucial and absolutely fascinating, which is why I am so excited to share with you my conversation with Keshet Star. So I want to begin not with the beginning of the story of Agunot, which stretches back. I mean, we have the Talmud, the Gemara talks about this. I want to almost go back to 8 weeks ago, where all of a sudden, it seemed like out of the clear blue sky, social media had a renewed emphasis, something like I've never seen before. Like, I've seen trickles here and there, but almost, I don't want to use the word weaponizing because that sounds too negative, but advocating on social media for the plight of women, and I haven't seen any, but perhaps men, but women who are stuck in marriages, they cannot get their divorce document according to halacha, known as a get, and there's so much advocacy going on social media. I want to hear from your perspective, how did this begin? You're an organization that you could tell me a little bit about what you do, but why all of a sudden are we seeing so much attention about this on social media?
So it's such a good question, and it really started with one case. There is a woman named Chava who was pursuing a get, had some hesitations about really taking her story public for some time, decided to go ahead and, you know, let it go public, share the story with the world, and It's always hard to know, and I'm no social media sort of algorithm person, so it's always hard to know why this story at this moment, what's going on in the news cycle and sort of just the culture that has something take hold like this. But I imagine maybe a little bit of what happened is that so many people don't realize that get refusal really happens. I get a lot of questions when people hear that I work on get refusal full time. Many people will say like, oh, is that like, you know, 2 hours a week? Like that?
Is
can't...
that like a hobby? Is
right.
That like a side, like
you
woodworking?
Must do that on the side, you know, when you're done with your real job. People are really surprised.
Like, I like painting, woodworking. I do get refusal.
Exactly. From 8 to 10 on Monday nights. And so people are really surprised that this happens. And I think that it's sort of human nature. Even if we know that it happens, we assume that it happens to someone else. Someone who maybe had their own issues or maybe wasn't perfect themselves. But when you hear a story and you see a face and you realize that, oh my gosh, that could be me or that could be my friends or my sisters or anyone that I know, there's something really powerful about that. And so I think for whatever reason, this was sort of the right story at the right time, but it really created this sort of movement that I think started on social media, but we also really saw the power of social media in that it really trickled outside of that. It started as something that was just happening in sort of the Instagram square on your phone, and it really grew beyond that into just a lot of people talking and thinking and wrestling with this issue who have probably never had it cross their minds in the past 10 years at least. So it's been remarkable.
One thing that I've noticed that made this feel very different is the involvement and inclusion of so many men getting involved. And this is kind of what I want to ask you about. Oh, tell me a little bit about Aura Does, and I have a foundational question to understand, because when I first, I'm not a big Instagram person. I am a social media person. I'm on Twitter way too often. I got to get off of Twitter. God should give me help and protection. It's not even true. I love what I do on Twitter. I think it is real holy work, inspiring. You can inspire people on social media, but here's my foundational question. I open up Instagram and I'm tagged in like 30 posts. Like they tag me. I open up Instagram not that often. I post on stories maybe once a week. And I had this question, who am I being asked to advocate against? Like I always get, and maybe this is wrong. I want to like admit this publicly. Like I get nervous right when I see this. Am I advocating against the rabbis because they're not doing enough? Am I advocating against the Beis Din? Am I advocating against the husband? What is the focus of the social media advocacy?
So there's really a range on social media. And I think that's why you do to some extent have to filter and pick and choose what messages resonate with you and what you're comfortable with sharing on your own platform. For some people, it's a laser focus on the husbands. I will say for us, the way that we do our work, and I'm happy to share more about that, is really focused on the husbands. This is the get refuser. We are addressing the system, but we're not necessarily calling out rabbis. We also don't know that that's the most effective means of creating this kind of change. For some people, the message is really about rabbis and halacha, and the husbands are almost sort of the PS to it. They're not really the focus. So you do see a range of messages and what people take away when they are exposed to this issue.
So what tools do you have aside from rallies? What tools do you have to apply pressure for a get? Aside from, obviously, we have the get and we have this husband who's living their life. What does Aura do aside from just constant rallies outside of people's houses? Maybe that's the only thing that you can do. What are the means of pressuring a husband to give a get?
So it's funny because people assume that we rally all day, and we actually rally in a fraction of our cases because most of what we do is a little more behind the scenes. And we have a few different program areas where over the years, we've also started to focus on prevention, that it's one thing to get an active, horrible Agunat case and try to fix it. But if you can stop that case from happening in the first place, that's 10 times more powerful. But in terms of the Agunat cases that come to us, the first thing we do when we get a case is talk to everyone we can possibly talk to and make sure we're understanding the issue. Because sometimes on the surface, the nature of the problem is actually different than what you find when you go a little deeper. We always, always reach out to the other side. They may curse us out and hang up the phone. That's their choice. But we always open the door for that communication because sometimes it's really communicating with the other side, especially if the communication has been broken down for a long time, that really gets the case moving. Sometimes it's encouraging people back into a process. You still have these 5 unresolved issues. Let's help everyone figure out a forum that they're comfortable with to get those issues resolved and get you all sitting at the table again. Sometimes it's working behind the scenes with rabbis, community members. We had a case where the husband and his family were visiting another city for Rosh Hashanah. We got every rav in that city to agree that they would not give any kibbutim or aliyot to the husband.
Any honors, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Any honors in the service to the husband and his family members. And 3 days after the holiday ended, they gave a get. And again, and this was also a case where the husband was getting a lot of support from his family. So it was really like they gave a get. And so again, it can vary tremendously. The way that we try to approach pressure is to always keep in mind 2 things, which is that the anticipation of pressure is worse than the pressure itself. It's like, imagine you're 5 years old and you're at the doctor's office getting ready to get a vaccine, or potentially as an adult getting ready to get a vaccine. It's that moment before the needle goes in that's the most stressful.
I love that point. I'm just going to jump in because I remember.
Yes, please.
I have a friend whose father actually went to jail. I have more than one friend whose father went to jail. And I remember he was describing what the family went through. It doesn't even matter what the circumstances were. And he said the point that was the most difficult for the family was the anticipation. Was that the anticipation of the punishment was almost scarier than the punishment itself, where you know, okay, this is what it is. And that in a way, knowing that you have that in your toolkit, so to speak, is probably even more ominous than the actual punishment.
100%, because you know what? Once there's a rally outside your house and you're like, okay, I survived that, it's almost empowering, you know? That wasn't so terrible. And that's why we always build in a warning that it's not just that we're going to show up out of the blue and have a rally. We want you to know that there's going to be a rally because we are most likely to get a get the day before the rally, not the day afterwards. That it's that moment of anticipation. We actually had a case, I want to say last year, shortly before COVID, we had a rally in Florida. The get was given 2 hours after the rally. There were negotiations pretty much throughout the night. I think I fell asleep holding my phone, actually, and woke up a few hours later. And it was really the movement happened, even though the case wasn't resolved until shortly after the rally, the movement all happened before the rally. So we always try to reach, we always make sure to reach out to the other side, make sure there's that warning. We build in that anticipation and that we also do it incrementally because what you don't want, you want someone to feel that they cannot live their lives as usual while they are also engaging in this form of abuse. So that's what we want. We don't want you to be able to go about your business as if you weren't refusing a get. But on the other hand, if the person feels that that's it, it's over, I'm never going to be able to date again, I'm never going to be able to be part of the community again, I am completely a pariah, then they don't have an incentive to actually give the get. So we also try to do it incrementally. So there's a sense of, yes, people know about this, this is uncomfortable, but it could also get worse. Why don't you give the get now before it has a chance to get any worse?
I'm so curious about, again, and I'm thinking of something fairly specific, but there's something like very scary. It's really anytime I open up social media, I do this. Like you are giving a lot of power to almost the mob mentality because not everybody has the same information as you. And I'm curious if you've ever had to ask people who are want to advocate to almost scale it back because they're using too many of their chips. Like, the specific thing, and I brought this up in the interview with Barry, who we're talking, we'll drop later, Barry Mitzman. I noticed it wasn't her. There was somebody on social media who specifically called out a rabbi who, like, I respect to the high heavens. And the rabbi actually responded, like, I was kind of shocked that I got called out so publicly on social media. And I'm curious how often, if ever, you have to talk to the other fellow advocates on this issue and say, let's be strategic about this. Like, we can't ostracize this cause from the community because the community itself is what gives us our power. Does that make sense?
It definitely does. And I also think we have to separate advocacy on an issue from advocacy on a case. That sometimes what's best for the issue is not what's best for the case. And sometimes they do converge. I do think that we are fortunate to have a lot of voices out there, especially right now, because there are some voices that have a very different style than what we have at Aura, and there's a place for that in the conversation. So it's not only a bad thing, but absolutely cases have to be strategic. Sometimes well-meaning people will sort of take things 100 miles a minute in a way that doesn't work. What I think is another really important piece to keep in mind with all advocacy is that it really has to be focused on what the aguna wants and needs. That if she's the expert on this guy, she was married to him, she knows what it's like to sort of walk on eggshells around him, and she's usually the best resource to know that, you know what, I actually think a full court press is the best thing here. Or, you know what, I think we have to be more thoughtful and more strategic. And sometimes in the energy to do things, people will kind of railroad what the aguna wants. And I'm not talking about anything going on social media right now or any specific case, but just over the years, I've gotten calls from family members saying, can you have a rally for my cousin, and we just won't tell her. And we have to really explain that's not actually helpful because it's her life. She's the one that's going to have to deal with the ramifications of whatever happens, and she's the one who knows him best. So you really want her taking the lead in making decisions and deciding what she's comfortable with and what she's willing to risk. And sometimes aguna get to a place where they're like, you know what, I don't think I'm getting my get anytime soon. And I would rather almost sacrifice my own case in order to bring attention to this issue. And I'm willing to make that trade right now. So it's really a question of what they want and what they're comfortable with.
So let me ask you a third rail question. And pretend I know nothing. And we can dive into more of the statistics. But I saw somebody ask this on social media. And they probably were coming, I don't know what place they were coming from, but I know it's a third rail question. I've heard, again, I'm scared I'm incriminating myself. I'm happily married, God forbid, signed the prenup, did all this stuff. I've heard that a lot of aguna issues really come down to custody issues, where the woman is unwilling to have a custody arrangement that the man finds beneficial. So therefore, the only bargaining chip, so to speak, is the get in order for him to be able to see his children. A, how often are you seeing that as the cause for the aguna issue? And what's the, I don't want to say what's your response, but like, is that, how do you look at that position?
I'm so glad you asked that because that is really, I think, the new million-dollar question when it comes to aguna advocacy. It comes up so, so often. A few things that are just good to know about the landscape of this issue, because most people don't know them.
Me included. I don't know a thing. I don't want. Right.
And again, I think just, you know, most of us don't. There's plenty of things I don't know about. A lot of people assume that moms have this upper hand in terms of custody and family court. That was true in the 70s, 100%. It is true in other countries in the world. But in the United States right now in 2021, that is not true. You are most likely to get joint custody or something very similar to joint custody than to get anything else. And to even ask to not have joint custody is kind of a risky move because the court might look at you as sort of, it's called a hostile parent. If the court thinks that you're not supportive of the other parent's relationship with the child, then the court can really punish you for it. And so a lot of times it's framed as, well, she has the upper hand in court and he has the upper hand with the get, so it's even. But it's so important to realize she doesn't have that upper hand in court. That's sort of an imaginary upper hand. The other piece that's really important to realize is that it is very unusual for a parent to not see their children at all. That's not typical. And when that's happening, it's often a red flag that something weird is going on, that there's maybe abuse allegations, that there's maybe a history where the parent has not shown up to 5, 10, 15 visits, and after a while, the psychologists involved recommend that visit stop. But it's very, very atypical. And what we have to think about, because I think that with all the focus we have on Agunot, which is so important, we also have to remember that children don't have much, if any, voice in these divorce proceedings. We want children to really have their needs looked at by a third party. And what happens is that when the get and custody get intertwined, what ends up happening is that the person withholding the get kind of uses the get as leverage. You want the get, then you're going to make me happy on the custody piece. And maybe what they want is what's best for the children, and it might actually be terrible for the children, but we don't really know because there's no objective third party investigating the facts and making that call. So when there's a complex custody issue, court is not perfect. I'm the first person to say that. But it is better than an extortion agreement, essentially, when it comes to protecting the rights and the needs of children. And so it's really important to separate these issues. If parents cannot agree on custody, we really absolutely need a neutral third party, whether it's a beastin or a court, to make that determination. And when we conflate the get with custody, we really put children at risk. And just the last thing I'll say on it is that if you had to almost imagine, if I wanted to withhold a get, how would I do it successfully? Which is sort of a weird thing to think about, but to try it on.
Are you giving us a primer? This is,
I know,
is this
right?
On
we
your
go
website?
To some dark places here at Ora. You could walk around and say, listen, I'm not giving a get because I love controlling my ex. And you probably are not going to get a lot of community sympathy. But if you walk around and say, listen, I want to give a get, but I can't. I'm doing this for my children. And you know what? If people are going to have rallies outside my house, okay, what can I do? I love my children. I would walk through fire for my children. It is a much more compelling reason to not give a get. So we also, you have to take it with sort of a big tub of salt because...
Meaning sometimes this is a manipulative tactic that they're using to seem more sympathetic. But let me ask you, and we're going to get off this third rail, and I'm sure we'll find other third rail issues to talk about.
Yes.
There are plenty of third rails on this issue.
Talk away, but no worries.
But here's my question. Have you ever investigated a case and in fact found that the husband is correct? He wants to give a get, but he's worried that he's going to lose custody of the children, or maybe another reason. Have you ever investigated a Aguna situation and then walked away and said, you know what? It's not really the husband's fault right now. There are other factors that are making it more complicated. Has that ever happened? And like, what were the circumstances that would ever come to light that would justify you, ORA, the organization, saying, you know what, I'm sorry, this is not the kind of case that we're going to participate in?
So the only circumstances that would come to mind are a kidnapping. And people use the term kidnapping loosely, but I mean sort of a legally...
No, that's happened. I know of a real kidnapping case.
Right, exactly. So I'm saying a legally documented kidnapping, not that you move from Avenue M to Avenue P. And certainly if someone kidnaps children to a country that, you know, is not a signatory to the Hague Convention, there's no legal process you can use. Even then, I would say the get should be placed in escrow with a beastin, because it is never good for someone to be the judge and jury of their own case when it comes to giving the get. So even then, the get should really be released to a third party. In theory...
And you have mechanisms that allow you to have the get in escrow, so to speak, in a third party, waiting for other issues to resolve, but you know that the final... Everything that one party could do has already been done, essentially.
Exactly. And again, the other situation I could think of, say, a woman saws her husband's arm off and is in prison serving a sentence for it. Even then, he should give the cat. I don't know what anyone's gaining from not giving it at that point. That sounds like a relationship that should have ended a while ago. But again, so you have these extreme, extreme outliers, but the average case is not that. And what's so important to realize also is that every get refuser thinks that they're the exception. They really believe that they're doing this because they have to do it. And they are anxious. And it's normal to be anxious in a divorce. It's very scary. But what I think many of them don't realize, and in my time at Aura, I've spent hours on the phone with get refusers talking this through, is that you're holding on to the get because you're anxious, but then it's making the things you're anxious about that much worse. You're anxious about the future, so you're holding on to the get, and now you actually can't have a future because you're staying stuck in this relationship and you're dealing with this community pressure. Or you're holding on to the get because you want to see your kids more, but your kids are growing up watching you not give a get and getting resentful towards you and not wanting to come on visits. That it really has a way of backfiring.
So let's talk about what you said. Everybody thinks that their case is not the average case. Let me ask some basics of what, in fact, I'm sure there's like a pie chart of stuff. How many cases do you see in an average year? And what would you say is are the basic typologies, plural, I assume is more than one, of the that contributes to an aguna situation? What are the common themes that you find?
So we see a real range of cases in terms of type and in terms of stage. How far along are they? I would say in terms of what's motivating the get refusal.
Wait, but could you first share the number? I'm just ballpark.
Sure. We work on average 75 cases at any given time. We resolve cases, we add new ones, and we typically work on another 300 cases that are earlier stage. So they're not necessarily at the level where they need our advocacy support, but there are red flags, there are concerns about get refusal, and we're providing strategic guidance as to how to navigate the Jewish divorce process. In terms of why people are withholding a get or what kind of reasons, what's behind it, there's a small minority that are still in love and want the relationship to continue. They haven't really come to terms with the fact that the relationship's over, and then the work is trying to help them do that. Some of them, and it's probably bigger than the love section.
If you didn't get that memo, yeah.
I know, if we can call them that.
Okay.
Where they're just really mad. And it's really revenge. One of our advocates was speaking with the get refuser and really trying to sort of get to the bones of why he wasn't giving the get. And after a while, the guy said, you know, this isn't going to sound very nice, but it just kind of makes me happy to know that she's suffering and it's because of me. And people don't get there 1 month after the divorce for the most part. But as you have an acrimonious divorce that goes longer and longer and longer, people want revenge. And it's not even about what I want now. It's that I feel wronged and I want to punish you. And so you have that. But by far the biggest group are people who are using the get as leverage. They want to get what they want in the divorce process. Sometimes they just want to keep it as an insurance policy. If I don't like what the judge rules, I can pull this get out of my back pocket and renegotiate. Sometimes the civil case is long gone, but they want things that they didn't get. And so the extortion piece is probably the most common. And what's common to every one of them is that it's really about power and control. And that's why we connect it so closely to domestic abuse. That huge percentages of these relationships, probably over 95% of the cases that we work on, experience multiple types of domestic abuse in the marriage. So these are abusive situations where power and control is the dynamic of the relationship all along. And then you move into the divorce stage and the controller doesn't want to give up the control. And the get is sort of an opportunity to maintain that control.
So for sure, online and what I've seen, all cases have involved women with a man refusing to give a get. I'm curious if Aura has ever dealt with a case. Again, the contours of Jewish law of how this could come up. We do require that a woman now accepts a get according properly, that she is willfully accepting it. That was one of the ordinances of Rabbeinu Gershom. And we also don't allow men to marry multiple wives. Have you had cases where the aguna is a man?
We have, and we work on those cases as well. They're a small minority for us, maybe 5%. And part of it, I think a lot of women don't know that they can refuse to receive a gift.
They just didn't get that memo.
So it could be that more people would if they knew it was an option. Who knows? But again, we typically see it the vast majority in one direction, but it can happen in the other direction, and we work on it the same way.
So I want to talk about loss of faith in this process and what people are witnessing. I suspect that part of people's hesitance to really get under this issue are two parallel tracks of concern for their own loss of faith. And when I say people getting involved, I mean people like me, David Beshefkin. There's like this concern of two parallel tracks of loss of faith. On the one hand, I think people are concerned about losing their faith in marriage. I know that when I was in yeshiva, somebody who I respect deeply didn't like the idea of getting involved in a prenup because he's like, why are you thinking about divorce at the very foundation of your marriage? And I think people are like afraid. There's a skit on Portlandia. There's this show called Portlandia where there's this skit about a married couple's friend who gets divorced. And they're worried that the divorce is contagious. They're worried that it's like, I don't want to get involved. Like, it's going to like rub off on you. I'm going to breathe it in. I need to wear a mask. I don't want to get involved in divorce issues because it's going to be contagious in my own life. It's like the fragility of marriage. You lose faith in marriage itself. And then there's a second track of loss of faith, and I'd love for you to discuss both in whatever order you find makes more sense, which is a loss of faith in the halachic process itself, losing faith in our tradition and our mesorah, the very bedrock where you could walk away and you're involved in this in so long. And I'm just seeing you through Zoom right now. You look like you have your faith intact on both of these issues. But somebody could walk away and feel halacha is misogynistic. The rabbis are just protecting the men. They're not trying hard enough. And you begin to see this, and I understand why somebody recoils and says, I don't want to get involved in these issues because I'm worried about my own faith. Like, I'm going to walk away from this and start being cynical about the process itself. How does Ora ensure that we do not lose our respective faiths in marriage and in halacha?
Such a thoughtful question. I'll start with marriage first. I don't know if that's the easier one or the harder one.
And can I ask, this might be, are you married? Just for our...
Yes, I'm married. 12 years now.
Okay.
If I remember correctly.
Okay.
Yes. Thank God. So in terms of the marriage piece, I think that most people, if they're honest with themselves, when they hear about the prenup for the first time, feel this like icky feeling of like...
Well, before you get it, explain what the prenup is so you could do it and then talk about the icky feeling, which I absolutely felt.
Absolutely. So the halachic prenuptial agreement is basically a document you can sign before you get married. You can also sign it as a postnup, so you can still be part of the fun if you're married. And it essentially prevents the get from being an issue later. And I'm happy to share more about how it technically does that. But I do think that most people, when they first hear about the concept, just feel this ickiness, like you're thinking about divorce, or you think prenup and you think like the Kardashians and, you know, what are, you know, everyone's protecting their like house in, you know, the Alps or whatever. And it doesn't feel Jewish and it doesn't feel hopeful and optimistic. And so I completely understand why it's a turnoff. And the two reframes I would offer, and this is a huge part of what we emphasize, we do a lot of educational programming in high schools to college students, etc., is that first of all, you hopefully are not signing a prenup for yourself. That's really not what it's for. If you're signing a prenup because you think your fiance is that much of a jerk that you need it, then go talk to someone about that. And if you feel that way, you want to be in touch with that feeling. But that it's really something that we do for other people. It's like getting a COVID vaccine, and vaccinations can be their own, you know, can of worms sometimes. But the idea is essentially that if everyone signs it, then the people who need it have it. And most people don't walk into marriage thinking it's going to be them. Some people like the idea of sort of an insurance policy. No one thinks it's going to happen to them, but this way you're protected if you do. But I actually think it's more powerful in the way I like to think about it is that it's a social responsibility thing. I don't think I'm going to need it. I'm confident I'm not going to need it. But someone out there is going to need it. And if I care about the Jewish community and I can do something that's going to take 10 minutes of my time and come at no cost, and it can potentially save someone else all of this horrible trauma, why not? How could I not do that as someone who's part of a community that I'm connected to? So to really frame it as not personal, but as something that we do because we care about each other. And then the second piece is that it's funny how we have this natural aversion to the idea of a prenup, and yet I personally have my ketubah in my nightstand drawer because I feel like I knew too much about it to sort of blow it up and have, like, you know, paper cutouts decorating it. That there's something interesting about the fact that we're used to signing a ketubah. A ketubah is...
Yeah, I'm just jumping in. I'm not a ketubah hanger-upper either. It's one of my... It's like the smallest pet peeve that I have in Jewish life. I think if you're asking, David, what is the tiniest pet peeve you have that you would not be willing to die even on any hill for? It's like hanging up the ketubah. Like, I notice it. I don't like it. I'll never say anything. It's the teeniest, tiniest pet peeve I have. So you're not a ketubah hanger-upper either.
I am not a ketubah hanger-upper because if you actually read it, it's not,
a prenup.
You know, I love you forever. I'm going to make you a banana smoothie every day. Like, it is essentially a prenuptial document about death and divorce. And before we think that that's super unromantic, I think the second reframe we can use is to really think about sort of what commitment actually is. That when you're married for a long time, or I don't know if 12 years counts as a long time or a short time, but you start to realize that the moments where your marriage really matters the most, the moments where it's the most tested, are not when you're on vacation in Italy eating gelato, but when things are falling apart, when you're suffering, when things are going wrong. That real love and real commitment is not about the unicorns and the rainbows. It's about what happens when everything does fall apart, what's left after that. And I think the commitment that we make to each other in Jewish marriage is that I love you so much that I want you to be taken care of and to be treated well and to be safe, even if it all falls apart. Because that's what real love is. It's not just when everything's perfect, but we stand under the chuppah and we read this ketubah because we love each other enough that you want your partner to be protected, even if the worst happens. And so I think that is another way to think about the prenup, that we are a religion that believes in reality. It's not just, you know, we're going to assume everyone lives happily ever after, but that we care about each other enough to make sure that we're safe and that we're okay, even if it all falls apart, because that's what it really means to be committed.
I actually, it's strange because when I was in yeshiva, and I may have mentioned this before, my absolute favorite mesechta, the tractate that I studied most, and that I'm not a scholar of scholars, but the one tractate that I actually feel comfortable page for page talking about is Maseches Gittin, the tractate that talks about the laws of divorce. And I always found it, again, the notion of agunot is absolutely heartbreaking, but the finality, the seriousness of the commitment of marriage in the Jewish community is actually something that I have found somewhat inspiring, and an outgrowth of that, which is the tragic outgrowth, is agunot. There shouldn't be any more. But we kind of created this system where the very commitment of marriage is not something you kind of walk in and out of when it's wonderful and sweet and nice and what did you say? I love you forever, now I want to make you a banana smoothie. That is the sign I would hang up in my house, FYI.
So, I do like smoothies.
So I really do appreciate that. And what age do you think it's appropriate to start talking about this? Because one issue that I've always had, and I've actually spoken to other organizations about this that have actually upped their game a great deal, is marriage education usually comes like too little too late. It's like you're about to get engaged, like, oh, I guess I should listen to something or somebody on this, when I think a lot of this needs to happen a little bit earlier. So when do you start educating the community about this? Because Ora does do education on this, I assume.
We do, and we educate all different audiences, including rabbis, attorneys, court personnel, you know, different players in the divorce process. But we like to start in high school, and I think there could be age-appropriate ways to do it earlier. My goal is that by the time someone is engaged, they've heard about the prenup at least three times from different sources. I think that's ideal. Better that you hear about it when you're not dating the person you're going to marry and it doesn't feel awkward and personal and it's general. And people worry sometimes, sort of a similar thread of this, that we don't want to scare kids. We don't want to, you know, sit down our high school seniors and be like, hey guys, you're about to be adults. The world is a terrible place. Good luck. And our messaging is really not about that at all, that there's a real empowerment focus, that yes, there's this problem, but look, there are also solutions and you personally can do something that's part of the change. And that, again, you have the ability to help each other and that you're not sitting ducks waiting for something bad to happen, that you're educated and informed and empowered and have tools to help yourselves and to help each other. And I think it can be a really encouraging message for young women. And it's important to...
And young men.
And young men, critical for both of them. And it's important to really train students for the actual world that they're going to encounter when they... you know, leave sort of the bubble of yeshiva high schools and that they're prepared for that. I think there are absolutely positive and age-appropriate ways to do that.
So let's talk about the second rail. And I'm happy that, you know, speaking as a woman, I'm sure it affects you, what you see. You know, it affects everybody in different ways, but I'm curious the way you look at it. You're not just a woman. You're not just a married woman. You're a married woman who's dedicated her life to circumnavigating and figuring out how to resolve one of the ugliest parts that emerges from one of the most beautiful parts of Jewish life, which is the marriage. And the ugliest part is the when the marriage not only deteriorates, but it refuses to end. It's a dead marriage, as I've heard some people say. How do you advise people to keep their faith in the halachic system and the halachic process?
I think the first piece is to validate that it's difficult. We joke at Ora that we're not invited to too many Kiruv events, and we're probably not going to be. This is not an issue.
Outreach, yeah.
Yes, exactly. This is not an issue that makes Judaism look good. And I think we can be honest with that, and it's important to have a space to struggle with that. I also feel that certainly when we're talking to people going through this issue, there's a huge power in having Orthodox people working on this issue, that there's something corrective just in seeing that, yes, we have this problem, and we also are doing what we can to take care of it, that there's also a commitment from within the community, not just outside the community, but from within to making a change. I think for me, I really believe with every fiber of my being that this was not the way this halacha was intended to be used, and that it is a manipulation of sort of the intention of the halachic system.
The get, you're talking about the get, the divorce document.
The get, exactly. That it was not meant to be used in the way that it's being used. Now, I still hear the question of, well, why is there the design flaw then, right? If this is happening and it's not supposed to happen, then what went wrong? And being very transparent, I think the best answer I've heard on this came from an interview I actually heard pretty recently with Rabbi Sacks, Zecher Tzedek Livracha, before he passed away. And one thing he shared is that he was asked in the interview, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? And his answer, which he says a lot more eloquently than I will, was something like, well, maybe we're not supposed to really understand why bad things happen to good people. Because if we understood it, we would accept it. And if we accepted it, we wouldn't fight to change it. And that maybe in some areas, God keeps us in the dark because God wants us fighting to create the change. And that's the most satisfying answer that I found, that I don't understand it either. I wish I had the magic solution. But I also feel that I feel so strongly that this is not the way this was intended to be used. And I'm okay with not understanding it as long as I'm able to be part of the change. And I've been fortunate to be able to see that change and that forward progression, which is really powerful. And I also think in general that we have to trust that our faith is strong enough to struggle and to have weak points and to have questions and to have moments where you do feel a little, you know, shaky. I think that a lot of people are afraid to jump into issues that might bring those things up. And there's an ebb and a flow. And because I do this professionally, I work really, really hard, sometimes with better success than others, depending on the stage of life in the day, but to have a really engaged spiritual life, because I can't only do this. I also have to tap into the things that remind me how much beauty there is in this religion and in this community, because if I'm not actively connecting with that and I'm just seeing all this bad stuff, it does wear on you. So I think it's both. And I think also, I know I pray a lot in a typical day as we make difficult decisions, as we try to move forward on cases, and you can put everything you can out there. And it really still feels like a miracle every time one of these cases are resolved. Even if we wrote up a strategy and we followed the strategy and it worked, there's something very miraculous about it, because it can just as easily not work. The person can back out at the last minute. And so to try and see the miracles when they come, to connect in as much as you possibly can, to stand up for Agunot saying, nope, this is not Torah, this is not Halacha, and to provide some of that validation, that this, to sort of provide that corrective experience, and to trust that it's okay to go into that like dark, gnarly place under the rock sometimes, and trust that you're going to be able to come out of it.
I love the gnarly place. There's no question about that. I'm curious, and we're almost wrapping up here. I'm curious. I was going to ask, like, do you have any happy stories? Obviously, any time it's resolved is happy, but I'm curious if you have any full-blown teshuva stories, like an act of repentance where through your efforts, did you ever transform a husband who not only gave a get, but said, you know what? I was so wrong on this. I want to stand beside you and now be an advocate on this issue.
I wish I had a story like that, but I have gotten thank you notes from get refusers.
From husbands.
Yes, from husbands after the fact that I have. I don't think they always realize how much it's holding them back as well. Obviously, we're focused on the victim of the abuse, not on the perpetrator, but it doesn't help them either. And for every get refuser that thinks I'm doing this because it's helping me, it doesn't. It really keeps you stuck in a toxic situation.
It stunts their life.
Yes, it holds you back. It prevents you from meaningfully moving forward. So you'll definitely have get refusers that appreciate having had a space to talk, to the extent that they will sort of unburden themselves and talk to you, and that will tell you afterwards, like, you know, you were right, and I'm so glad that I did this, and I feel like a new lease on life now that this is gone and this is done. It would be pretty amazing if they then got in the picket line with us afterwards, so I'll have to keep looking out for that story. But I think they do get some perspective sometimes once they're out of the conflict.
So I always close with three questions. I ask all my interviews. First and foremost, is there a book or something more substantive for people who want to understand more of these issues, whether it's the issue of advocacy or the question about get in general? Is there a book or even an article that you would recommend to our listeners for more information?
So there are a lot of great resources on the Jewish law piece, including there's a book called The Abandoned Wife in Jewish Law. There's a book called Gray Matter. But I actually love a book called Daring Greatly by Brené Brown that is more about advocacy in general. But I think that when you put yourself out there on an issue like this, even on Instagram, there's a lot of blowback, there's a lot of critiques, there's a lot of stuff that comes with it. And I think it's a fantastic book for just giving you a grounding in saying what you believe in and letting people throw tomatoes a little bit and going with it.
Daring Greatly. That's the title, Daring Greatly?
Yes, Daring Greatly by Brené Brown.
I absolutely love that recommendation. My next question is, if somebody gave you a great deal of money that allowed you to take a sabbatical, go back to school, and write a PhD, what do you think the subject and title of that PhD would be?
Ooh, I almost went into academia, so this is a really good question. I think it would have something to do with Jewish women's narratives in sort of literature and culture. That's very vague, so I'd have to do a lot of work to specify it. But I'm always very interested in storytelling, and that's why I'm interested in seeing what's going on right now. Why this story, this moment, why do stories impact us so much more than anything else?
And you've really done a masterful job of sharing the story of Ora and of all of these women in a really sophisticated and substantive way. My final question, I am a terrible sleeper, and I always like to ask my guests, what time do you go to sleep at night? At what time do you wake up in the morning?
Ideally, like 11:15 and 7:15, but not always in practice.
Not always
in practice. The practice shifts a little bit.
Okay, I cannot thank you enough. This has been such a pleasure to speak about a sensitive, a timely, and such an important issue, I think, for everybody. Keshet Starr, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Growing up, Agunot for me was something extraordinarily distant. It was like watching people march or campaign or be part of some social justice movement that, however meaningful the cause was, it didn't really have any immediate bearing or relevance on me. And I think a lot of that changed when I met or had people within my orbit, both of whom kind of live quite close to each other, who dealt with this. And I think that what Keshet Starr helped me think about is that even if you are not the kind of person who is protesting kind of outside of somebody's house, that's not your personality, that's not something that you can do, there are other ways to educate yourself. And a theme that we will come back to over and over again, and I believe this is true on a Torah sense, that part of educating yourself about a healthy marriage, part of that is educating yourself about a healthy divorce. Nobody plans on getting divorced. Nobody wants to get divorced. But knowing the healthy way to do it and the right systems to protect both your spouse, the person you're in a relationship with, but more importantly, as we will discuss much more in a future podcast, protecting you from yourself, from your own worst instincts, is something that we really need to think more carefully about. And it doesn't need to be ugly. We can think about healthy divorce even as we think about healthy marriage. It doesn't undermine it. The fact that you could think about such a thing, I think the analogy of insurance, which we come back to, nobody plans on dying young, but we still advocate for having life insurance. And in a similar way, a part of a healthy marriage is making sure that you have the systems in place to make sure that, God forbid, it should never happen, but if it does not work out, it will be in the healthiest way possible for you, for children if they are involved, for you entering a relationship, and also for you to exit. So thank you so much for listening. It wouldn't be a Jewish podcast without a little bit of schnarring. So if you enjoyed this episode or any episode, please subscribe, rate, review, tell your friends about it. It really helps us reach new listeners and continue putting out great content. And as I mentioned in the intro, we're also doing something exciting this month. We have a voicemail set up at 917-720-5629. We are looking for feedback, questions, criticisms, all the good stuff from our listeners. So please call the number, leave a message, and you can be featured on a future episode, our anniversary episode. Again, the number is 917-720-5629. 917-720-5629. I think I said that number one too many times, and maybe that's what you will call and fetch about. If you'd like to learn more about this topic or some of the other great ones we've covered, be sure to check out 1840.org. That's the number 18 followed by the word 40, F-O-R-T-Y.org, 1840.org. You'll also find videos, articles, and recommended readings. Thank you so much for listening, and stay curious, my friends.